And then she told me that her granddaughter... John, are you listening to me?
Of course I am, Mom.
Well, then why are you on your phone, ignoring your poor mother who only loves you and wants to spend time with you?
I was doing some banking on the Wells Fargo mobile app and I got carried away. Pay your bills? Done. Check your balances? Done. Deposit checks? Done. Even send and receive money? Are you updating your status right now?
With the Wells Fargo mobile app, it's easy to get banking done. Learn more at wellsfargo.com/getbankingdone. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A., member FDIC.
Blog Talk Radio.
After this, there is no turning back. You take the blue pill. The story ends. You wake up in your bed and believe whatever you want to be. You take the red pill. You stay in Wonderland. And I show you how deep the rabbit hole goes.
You're listening to the Revolutionary Radio Project. With your host, Rob Skiba.
All I'm offering is the truth.
Hello and welcome to the Revolutionary Radio Project. I am your host, Rob Skiba, and this is Virtual House Church 22. And this is actually going to be a pre-recorded show tonight. Sheila and I are in California right now, visiting friends and going to the Angels or Aliens conference with Doug Hamp, L.A. Marzulli, and Gon Shimura. And so we couldn't do this live tonight, but I thought I'd do something a little bit different and let you sit in on a typical house church setting at Kevin and Amanda's house. And what I did do is put the audio from Bible.is that we're used to listening to in place of people reading the scriptures. Usually in this in the house church environment, somebody volunteers to read whatever passage of scripture, but rather than listen to stutters and uhs and ums and different translations and that sort of thing, I figured I'd keep things consistent and use the Bible.is New Revised Standard Version dramatized audio that we've been using all along. So that's the only thing that I changed out. I just replaced people reading with the dramatized audio from Bible.is. But then everything else is the way it was in, last week in our house church study. So join us now for week 22. We'll be looking at Exodus chapter 35 right through the end of the book, chapter 40, verse 38. Here is Virtual House Church 22 as recorded at Kevin and Amanda's house in our Shabbat service.
So where are we this week? Y'all know we're going to finish Exodus today? We start in Vayikel, he assembled, starting in, like in verse, look, chapter 35, verse 1. And for those who haven't been here before, we basically take volunteers and we go one chapter at a time and talk. You know, the volunteer reads it and we spend time talking through it. And what I'll, just to kind of prepare you for today, there's a lot of detail. But what's kind of exciting about this is, as we've talked in the past, the tabernacle and all of its furnishings and everything was what Moses was instructed by God to build. And it was based on when he went up to the top of the mountain and he poked his head into the cloud and he got to look into heaven. And so what I think is amazing is the intricate level of detail that Moses talked about before, but now we're moving from the product concept to implementation. So today is implementation day. For those who are like project management type, you know, now because it seems like it's repetitive, but really what it is, it's a wonderful confirmation that this Beit Salel,
he was the project manager. He was the guy who was in charge of making it all happen. But then Moses had to do all the organizing and put it together. And then as Moses finishes up, you can see the glory of God says, yep, that's my place. And that's when he rests. But what's amazing to me about this is with like five chapters worth of, you got, you know, bronze, you know, tent pegs. You got gold this, sockets of silver. You got all these little details. And what it shows you is that God's plan was perfectly implemented without any missing pieces, without anybody worrying about, hey, did somebody grab one of my gold coins and melt down my earring and take it for their own use? I mean, it was, they had so much that God has to, all right, the guys had to say, all right, that's enough. We don't need any more gold. I mean, how many building programs have ended that way? It's too much money. Don't give us any more. You know, so this is how God does it. And so just I wanted to just emphasize that as we go and read it, because it's easy to kind of get lost with a lot of the details. But understand, this is the best description of what you're going to see in heaven. And it's right here in this tabernacle. So with all of that, who wants to move forward with
chapter 35?
I'll take it.
Okay. And Rob, could I ask that we just read that first, like maybe 1-3 and talk about it, because that one's a logical place to stop.
I actually have a break right there.
All right, look at that. Very good. All right.
Exodus 35. Moses assembled all the congregation of the Israelites and said to them, "These are the things that the Lord has commanded you to do. 6 days shall work be done, but on the seventh day you shall have a holy Sabbath of solemn rest to the Lord. Whoever does any work on it shall be put to death. You shall kindle no fire in all your dwellings on the Sabbath day."
All right. So is this worth chatting about? Does that make anybody have any questions?
Well, I find it interesting. We see the same thing in last week's study where Bezalel is first called out as a person who is the first person in the Bible actually filled with the Holy Spirit.
Mm-hmm.
And so you got in chapter 31, you know, that Bezalel and Aholiab are going to be the guys doing all the work. And then in verses 12 through 18, God says, but make sure you don't do any work on the Sabbath day. And I think that that's specifically in there for people like me. Because as a creative person, when I get the creative juices flowing, I hate stopping.
Yeah.
I'm a workaholic. I mean, I'll just keep going and going and going like the Energizer Bunny. And these guys were so talented and they had this tremendous work to do, but as if to tell them,
don't forget,
stop working on the Sabbath day, keep it holy. That's pretty, and so we get the reiteration of that right there in chapter 35.
That's an amazing observation too, because he's even saying, look, I know I've commanded you to do this, and this is one of the most important things I've done up to this point in human history, and this is a big project. I mean, we're talking something that's the size of half a football field with some of the most elaborate, ornate furnishings ever known to mankind. Priceless. I mean, we could talk about how much the gold is worth and all that, but really, how much would something like, and it's, you can't literally put a price on the value of those articles. And but for him to say, but remember, I want you to take a rest, so don't even work for me on a project that I'm telling you to do. It's going to take you a while to build it, right? They didn't get started with it until it was like the first year when they got to finish it. So it was a long-term project, and I think it's amazing how God doesn't expect us to wear ourselves out, even when he calls us to do it, because he can make provision for us to get rest. So that's a very good observation, Rob. Very good. He did make it for us to get the rest that we need.
I have a question.
Mm-hmm.
So during the time they're making all this, they pretty much were in one spot, right? I mean, they didn't do any moving.
There's still the base of Mount Sinai.
Still at the base of Mount Sinai. It kind of amazes me, you know, that they would have to, I mean, I imagine they would feel like, wow, we're doing this, but aren't we supposed to be going toward the promised land? And just to stop and only go when, I mean, that's a lot of patience. Because,
mm-hmm.
I mean, it's at Sinai, I've been out there, it's hot. I mean, it's not a really luxurious place. you know, to be out in the tents, but to live in that kind of obedience and with that kind of patience, you know, to just continue to do the building of the temple, you know, and it seems like maybe you're going nowhere, but that is significant when the temple is us, and sometimes it may feel like we're not going anywhere, but he's just working on that when we were wanting to go to the promised land, but maybe sometimes just that nothing, just there, just keep plugging away, you know, beating the gold or whatever you're doing, you know, to build that temple, or he's going to abide in, sometimes in our lives, in my life.
Well, who is the temple in this modern day?
Us.
Yeah, so it might be he has to work on this a little bit.
Yeah.
And I just wanted to share with the person that we were talking today, and where it says not to light a fire or to set a kindle fire in any of your dwellings on the Sabbath day. And it just reminded me in James where it talks about the tongue setting a fire, and with us being the temple or the tabernacle, that we should watch the words that we say, and not, you know, we ought to keep this day holy. And so I just kind of liken that, because, you know, you always hear where you shouldn't do this, or you shouldn't drive a car, but, you know, we are spirit beings. And so as we all being the tabernacle of the Holy Spirit, it says do not, you know, with our tongue, you know, we ought to keep our mouth from deceit, or our lips from speaking any type of evil, you know, and especially amongst each other. You know, so
that's a very good spiritual interpretation of that, because it is starting an argument, like a heated argument. Think about, you know, even when the term anger in the Hebrew, it really relates to having a red nose. You know, because when you're angry, it's like a big honker, big red nose, because you're angry. Yeah, and so that literally, I forget the actual Hebrew word, but it relates to the being red nosed, and that's what that's what is translated into angry. So definitely. Other thoughts?
Well, we were listening to Nehemiah, and who was the other guy?
Keith Johnson,
those guys. We didn't get to finish it. We were listening to it on the way here. But they're talking about the whole idea of this Shabbat candles, how that's rabbinic, that they would light the candles on Friday night, so or before sunset, I guess, so that they would have a fire, that they wouldn't have to start a fire.
But they make it a commandment. That's not really a commandment.
It's not a commandment, but that's where the tradition of lighting candles Friday came from.
Right.
And keeping the stove lit all weekend.
Yeah, right.
They do.
Up to 400 degrees. And
that's a good electric bill there. Yeah.
So, yeah. The stove's for cooking. So, you know, some fried eggs, that's all right, as long as the fire's been burning since Friday night, Friday afternoon. But one of the things about this whole thing about those who don't partake of the Sabbath, they would actually be cut off or they would die. And I think about it in terms of prophecy, because, hey, if we had an outage, if there was a hurricane or something or a terrible snowstorm and AT&T calls me, I'd have to go in and take care of it. I mean, that's what I have to do. Thank the Lord that I don't have to. But, you know, does that mean, so when I pull in and take care of the problem, I'm going to die afterward? I mean, you know, so it's
well, I think you should tell them no.
Yeah, well, maybe I will, but I'm just saying, you know, it depends on the situation. You know, it's not, I'm not doing it to earn my income. I mean, if it's an emergency, like is it like a situation like that, and people's lives are at stake.
That's true, because you didn't say you would even save your donkey.
Right.
In a whole lecture, you can go
out. There's a lot of donkeys out
there. Well, I think the issue is going back. You got to put it in a cultural context, right? First of all, these guys are in the desert, so finding firewood would be a bit of a chore.
Mm-hmm.
And then whatever wood you found, you would have to work to chop it down and cut it and make kindling out of it. And so there's actually work involved in those days in making a fire in your home.
Right.
It's not like, you know, these are all fires in our home right now.
Yeah.
You know, the light bulbs.
They didn't have matches back then either.
Right. It was work. You know, now you just got to turn on the light
switch.
Right. But where I was going with that was, yeah, we can look at it from a historical, cultural context, but I'm looking at it from a future prophetic context.
Hmm.
because it says in Revelation that those who take the mark of the beast, there's no rest day or night for them. And that means they don't get Shabbat. They'll be wishing they could have a Saturday day off, and but there's no rest day or night. They got to work 7 by 24 by 365. Yeah, I mean, it's we're close to it, but you know, it's going to be enticing to take that mark because it says here that no one, you know, that when this false prophet arises, you know, he says it forces everyone. It says it forces everyone. It's not really going to be much of a choice. It's you're going to be forced to do it, great and small, rich and poor, free and slave. So you're not above it, you know, to receive a mark on his right hand or on his forehead, preventing anyone from buying or selling, unless he has the mark, and that is the name of the beast or the number of his name. And so it's going to be compelling, but if you take that mark, so much for Shabbat. So in that case, you will die, because if God says you want to be aligned with me, then we need to be filled with his mark. He needs to write it on our foreheads, like Kadosh Le'ovah, holy to the Lord, just like the high priest has, because our high priest, Yeshua, in the order of Melchizedek, he had that crown of thorns, but now he's going to have Kadosh Le'ovah on his head when he comes back with that glorious crown. So we want to make sure we have his sign and not the mark of any worldly system, no matter what it costs us, because it'll cost us our eternal life if we take it. And it's going to come. It's going to be a requirement. I mean, and there's technologies out there that could enforce something like that right now, just based on your own phone that you have right here in your pocket or your purse. You know? I mean, when you go to a cashless system, everything you have and everything you own is just a 1 or a 0 in somebody's database. And it could be like, delete. He's done. He's a security threat. Gone. And then that's it. So I just wanted to point out that I really do think that this is literal. That, you know, whoever is going to be working on it will be put to death, because at one day you won't have the choice. You're going to have to work on it if you take that mark. And that mark is a mark of death. So it's serious business. And I'm not trying to put a heaviness on everyone. I'm just, you know, saying
but
I believe
it
has to
be.
It is serious. We talked about it last week. And I had made a note last week in our study that the tribulation protection plan is in Exodus 34, 21 through 24, which was the last chapter we covered last week, where it starts in verse 21 of chapter 34, talking about the Sabbath day, and then the 3 times of the year that you're to gather and celebrate the feast of God. And the real clincher for me, 3 times each year, all the men of Israel must appear before the sovereign Jehovah, the God of Israel. No one will attack or conquer your land when you go to appear before Jehovah, your God, those 3 times each year. And I will drive out the nations that stand in your way and will enlarge your boundaries.
Mm.
So, I mean, that's the tribulation protection plan. I mean, there's 2 marks you're going to have to choose from. This one that we just read, or the one you're talking about, the mark of the beast.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the line's going to be drawn in the sand in the near future.
But fortunately for us, that proverbial line in the sand is like the days of Elijah, because he drew a line in the sand, and he says, choose this day you're going to serve. If it's the Baals, if it's the lords of this earth, then you go right on ahead, because you know what? I've been putting up with this for decades, years, centuries, and but now the time has come where I'm not putting up with it anymore. So to this day, you're going to have to choose who you're going to serve. If it's me, if it's Yehovah, then you come serve me. You do this my way. We're not going to do it in this Babylonian way anymore. But if you want to go do it the Babylonians, you can go right ahead. And that's why it's so beautiful, because Amos says that surely Jehovah is nothing without sending his secret counsel to his servants, the prophets. We mention this frequently. And he says also that before the great and terrible day of the Lord, he sends the prophet Elijah. So that's this anticipation that there is going to be a line in the sand, just like Rob said. And that's when the choice is going to be made, because if you're not on the right side of that line, Jehovah's side, then I think one of the first orders of business is going to be take the mark.
Uh-huh.
And that's why it's a choice. I do think we're going to have a choice in the matter. But once the time window is shut, if we haven't made the choice for Yehovah, then we will be forced to make the other choice. So just trying to talk through it. That's
it's
all.
Interesting. That was the Haftorah last week.
Mm.
Was 1 Kings 18.
Yeah.
That is that story.
Yep.
All right. Any other interruptions for Rob? I get a little long-winded sometimes. All right. You want to continue, man?
For
sure.
Four?
All right.
Moses said to all the congregation of the Israelites, "This is the thing that the Lord has commanded.
Take from among you an offering to the Lord. Let whoever is of a generous heart bring the Lord's offering. Gold, silver, and bronze, blue, purple, and crimson yarns, and fine linen, goat's hair, tanned ram's skins, and fine leather, acacia wood, oil for the light, spices for the anointing oil and for the fragrant incense, and onyx stones and gems to be set in the ephod and the breastpiece. All who are skillful among you shall come and make all that the Lord has commanded. The tabernacle, its tent and its covering, its clasps and its frames, its bars, its pillars and its bases, the ark with its poles, the mercy seat and the curtain for the screen, the table with its poles and all its utensils, and the bread of the presence, the lampstand also for the light, with its utensils and its lamps and the oil for the light, and the altar of incense with its poles, and the anointing oil and the fragrant incense and the screen for the entrance of the tabernacle, the altar of burnt offering with its grating of bronze, its poles and all its utensils, the basin with its stand, the hangings of the court, its pillars and its bases, and the screen for the gate of the court, the pegs of the tabernacle and the pegs of the court and their cords, the finely worked vestments for ministering in the holy place, the holy vestments for the priest Aaron, and the vestments of his sons for their service as priests.
Then all the congregation of the Israelites withdrew from the presence of Moses, and they came, everyone whose heart was stirred, and everyone whose spirit was willing, and brought the Lord's offering to be used for the tent of meeting, and for all its service, and for the sacred vestments. So they came, both men and women, all who were of a willing heart brought brooches and earrings and signet rings and pendants, all sorts of gold objects, everyone bringing an offering of gold to the Lord. And everyone who possessed blue or purple or crimson yarn or fine linen or goat's hair or tanned ram skins or fine leather brought them. Everyone who could make an offering of silver or bronze brought it as the Lord's offering. And everyone who possessed acacia wood of any use in the work brought it. All the skillful women spun with their hands and brought what they had spun in blue and purple and crimson yarns and fine linen. All the women whose hearts moved them to use their skill spun the goat's hair. And the leaders brought onyx stones and gems to be set in the ephod and the breastpiece, and spices and oil for the light and for the anointing oil and for the fragrant incense. All the Israelite men and women whose hearts made them willing to bring anything for the work that the Lord had commanded by Moses to be done brought it as a freewill offering to the Lord. Then Moses said to the Israelites,
"See, the Lord has called by name Bezalel, son of Uri, son of Hur, of the tribe of Judah. He has filled him with divine spirit, with skill, intelligence, and knowledge in every kind of craft, to devise artistic designs, to work in gold, silver, and bronze, in cutting stones for setting, and in carving wood in every kind of craft. And he has inspired him to teach, both him and Aholiab, son of Ahisamach of the tribe of Dan. He has filled them with skill to do every kind of work done by an artisan, or by a designer, or by an embroiderer in blue, purple, and crimson yarns, and in fine linen, or by a weaver, by any sort of artisan or skilled designer."
All right. Observation, thoughts?
Only those who are willing.
Oh, that's a big thing there.
He said it about seven times.
Yeah, at least.
Okay. Between those that had a willing heart and their heart was stirred,
yeah.
I counted seven times there. He said that.
Yeah. There was no twisting of arms or
demanding
or you're robbing God.
Yes.
Quoting Malachi before he was born.
Was there a pledge for him?
Was there a pledge for him?
That pledge form?
Yeah. Plus, he has filled us with what we need to build this tabernacle. He's provided it. He gave them what they needed.
That's right. And it was his will, and so he provided the provision. He gave the vision and the provision. If you want to use those kind of terms, You know. Go ahead, Darryl.
Well, what's interesting to me is just the whole different value system within Father's kingdom. You know, whether it's the kingdom of heaven or the worldly kingdom. And as you look, you know, they're able to give freely. Well, it probably is easier to give freely because it really didn't have the, quote, value that people put on gold. I mean, it was something that they used to create things of beauty. The things of God are creating things of beauty from our hands and the artistic things that will glorify Him. You know, because in the meantime, He provided the food, He provided the clothing, you know, their shoes didn't wear out, all this stuff He provided, so all of a sudden, all this extra stuff really ended up being, we can give it up so much more easily when we realize His kingdom is really not about what do I have. I'm having a hard time articulating it. But His kingdom and His value system is so different that the ability to give this stuff, what am I going to do with this jewelry in the middle of the desert? I'm not going to sit back and trade this and buy this. I don't need clothes. I don't need food. I can use my time to weave and to make things for the tabernacle. You know, I can do all this stuff because everything else is provided, and maybe as we learn to live within the kingdom of heaven, which is right now, you know, that can start happening with us. We start focusing on the things that are of great value to Him, which is creating beauty that glorifies Him, rather than struggling over how am I going to provide my food, or, you know, do I have, what stuff do I have, and how much money do I have? Maybe it's, you know, when we realize that His kingdom isn't of that. We're going to get a lot more generous, and it's a lot easier to give away this bauble that is really, in His currency, not that important. Mm-hmm. I don't know.
I think you're onto something, Darryl, too, because like when we read in Revelation, it says that the city is made of streets that have gold. On them. So what we're doing is we're hanging on to building material.
Asphalt.
It's a bag of concrete.
Yeah.
I mean, really, when you think about it, all this fine jewels and gold.
And the bag of concrete wants to do it, weighs you down. Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. That's good.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
Especially
stuff,
if it gets wet.
Stuff that weighs you down.
Yeah. I mean, but really, what we value so much is building materials in the heavenly. So, I mean, God has, what He values is you and you and you. It's the people. We are the temple that He's really most concerned about. He's not worried about this stuff you dig up out of the ground.
It was all about the heart right here, too.
I think it's
a willing heart, and that's why, to me, He led him in the desert for all that time, because it says He led him in the desert to test what was in their heart. When they got to the promised land, that wasn't a picture of heaven. Mm-hmm. They had to go and fight the ice when they got there. Mm-hmm. So they need to be led in the desert to be prepared to go in and fight the ice, because they needed to learn how to, you know, overcome in the desert so they can go in and do battle.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, too, it's a picture of the body. You know, there was one common goal of building the tabernacle, but that each one brought different gifts.
Yes.
You know, each of us have a different gift, but yet there's this one goal, there's one body, there's one God. And so, you know, all of them didn't bring acacia wood, mm-hmm. and there would have been something else lacking.
That's
and
right.
So I just see it as a picture of just the different gifts, but the same spirit that gives to all. And so...
Mm-hmm. That's good. And that again, amazing, because the New Jerusalem is compared to the bride of Christ. Well, if we're supposed to be the bride of Christ, the bride of Messiah, and we're one body with many parts, well, mm-hmm. each one has to do their part for the body to function. Like, if we were all a bunch of pancreases, we might not have an issue with diabetes, but we might need some skin to protect us from the sun, right? So somebody's going to be pancreas, somebody's going to be skin, somebody's going to be bones. I mean, we're all one body, many parts to make it function. So I think it fits in perfectly what you said. Everybody had to do their part. Their spiritual gift had to be applied for this tabernacle to work.
I also think, you know, we were talking about on the way here, these guys were slaves just a few weeks earlier.
Mm-hmm.
Well, where did they get all this gold, silver, and purple, and linen?
Yeah,
the Egyptians gave it to them. So that's,
you know, if we're looking at a greater Exodus,
they wanted them out of there. Right.
There's apparently going to come a time when the wealth of the wicked is stored up for the righteous.
Mm-hmm.
For building materials. But I mean, literally, these guys were all slaves right before that, so they've got a lot here to build that.
Yeah, that's right.
But the whole mindset would have to be father's values, which is so much different, because if it was the Egyptian values, they'd be holding on to that stuff.
And well, that's why I think it says those who are willing.
Yeah.
Because there probably were plenty that
hold on to it. Hold on to it.
We're talking about 2 million people.
Yep.
But what's interesting is how does that apply to me? You know, because I live in this world in which I survive by mammon. I mean, it really is. And yet we really do are transitioning into the kingdom of heaven right now and its value system as the old value system starts to die in me. And it's a little bit scary, you know, transitioning from how we've valued the things that kept us safe to really transition to the kingdom of heaven, which its values are so very different. And I just think it was a lot of freedom in that, but having for me to give up what I think is keeping me safe, you know, that I need to have this job or this money or this whatever, it's kind of radical, but look what it forms. When, you know, just give it away, because, and that's still hard for me. You know, there's certain things I'm going to give away a certain amount, but I give everything, you know, and all of a sudden, you know, everything that I've got in my bank account, if he called me to, I guess you're supposed to, you know, I would, but wow, that's radical.
It is. I mean, so I tell you what dovetails in with what you're saying there, Daryl, and if we could read this, because I think that this is a nice place to jump from the Torah to the New Testament. Just to tie this concept in, because Paul talked about it in 2 Corinthians chapter 9. Somebody want to read that? And it, I think it's like from 9, basically verses 1 through 11.
Second Corinthians 9.
Mm-hmm. We can just go like all the way through to like 15.
Okay.
The whole thing. Yeah. How about that? Second Corinthians 9. Somebody want to read it?
As it is written, he has dispersed abroad, he has given to the poor, his righteousness endures forever. Now may he who supplies seed to the sower and bread for food supply and multiply the seed you have sown and increase the fruits of your righteousness. Am I?
Second Corinthians 9?
Yeah.
Okay.
I've got New King James.
Oh, okay.
You want something different?
No. Keep going. I'm sorry.
While you are enriched in everything for all liberality, which causes thanksgiving to us, to God and I, for the administration of this service not only supplies the needs of the saints, but also as abounding through many thanksgivings to Adonai. While through the proof of this ministry, they glorify Adonai for the obedience of confession of the gospel of Christ and for your liberal sharing with them and all men. And by their prayer for you, who long for you because of exceeding grace of Adonai in you, thanks be to Adonai for his indescribable gift.
Mm-hmm. Is that in her?
Yeah.
How funny.
We just got some praises going on.
No kidding.
Right. Yeah, verse 10 in the New Letter, I actually have it underlined and highlighted in my Bible, so I've gone down this path once before. Probably because it deals with seed.
Yeah.
But it says, for God is the one who gives seed to the farmer and then bread to eat. In the same way, he will give you many opportunities to do good, and he will produce a great harvest of generosity in you. That's what Daryl's been talking about.
Mm-hmm. I agree, and I'll tell you what's kind of exciting is like, see, to me it's like the verse chapter 9 verse like 6 and 7, and this is I'll kind of emphasize it here. It says, here's the point. Mm-hmm. He who plants sparingly also harvests sparingly. Mm-hmm. Each should give according what he's decided in his heart, and not grudgingly. And not under compulsion, for God loves a cheerful giver. And that's the quote from
the Exodus passage. And he says, moreover, God has the power to provide you with every gracious gift in abundance, so that in always, in every way, you will have all that you need yourselves and be able to provide abundantly for every good cause. Mm-hmm. And so, to me, this is powerful, because when you can give with a willing heart, you don't need to be pounded over the head with the Malachi verse about robbing God, mm-hmm. even though we're not under the law. Well, if we're under that one. You know, and you don't need to sign pledge forms, and you don't need to do a lot of different things, because if it's in your heart, you're going to give it, and there's joy in it that way. And so that's the only thing I'm saying on that, is just that, you know, what we do within these small contexts, it really is kind of efficient, so it doesn't cost a lot of money to be able to come together and do these things. And but then when there are needs that do arise within the group, there's tremendous flexibility with the resources that we do have to be able to be a blessing to the people that need it. And so I'm so love everyone here, because there's been many, many times in the past when a need has arisen and this group has rise to meet it. And I'm just very thankful. And no one has to twist arms and send out harassing emails or reminders or put people on the spot, you know. And that's just, it's amazing. So to me, it really is a confirmation. But,
this reminds me of, like, the when they're trying to figure out who's the greatest, and he's like, well, the first shall be last shall be first, that bit. And he's like, if you, in order to be a leader, you must be a servant to everyone. Mm-hmm. And I feel like, you know, if you only serve a little people, like a little bit of people, then you're only going to be served back just a little bit, or you're only going to be a leader of so much. But if you're sitting there serving everybody, then you, in return, will gain.
Mm. That's good. Very good. All right. And then one thing I wanted to do is this picture here. This is the one I was talking about last week, and I couldn't find it, but I found it this week. And so it really kind of gives a nice, colorful representation here of the tabernacle. And it's, again, it's a little you have to think about it. You can't just look at it and get it in your head, because you remember you entered from the east, right? Mm-hmm. Or they got the east on the west. So imagine that you're a bird flying in, and you're over that portion of the tabernacle. You're flying in as a bird from the east, but you're kind of like on the northeast side, and you're looking down on it. It's because it really should kind of be like that. But anyway, you know, whether you're in the Goodyear blimp or a bird or whatever. But this, if you're looking at the dimensions, you know, this is the 150 feet, basically, for the length of it, and then it would be 75 feet wide. So in terms of, like, think about literally a football field. It's half the size of a football field. So this is a very large, construction project, if you will. And it's portable. That's what's amazing. You tear it up, set it down, and you move on to the next place. And so I just wanted to point out, you know, and we can either pass this around or, you know, as we're reading it, you can look up here as things are mentioned. You know, we've got the bronze altar, and they've got some lamb on there. And you've got the laver for washing, that's made out of bronze. And then you have the menorah here on the inside, the altar of the incense. You got the showbread with the table of the showbread. And then inside here is the Ark of the Covenant. And you can see they've drawn in the curtains with the angels, that the cherubim, is what they'll say in Hebrew, is the angels, with all the heavenly colors, the blue, purple, and scarlet, or red, and all of it woven together. And you've got the dyed roofing materials, you know, from the skins, the hides of the sea cows and all that. So it's all here. But what I wanted to also bring your attention to is this is really a beautiful picture of the robe of the Kohen Gadol, the high priest. And you can see how he has the white turban. So that's, you know, it's an elaborate hat. But then he's got this Kadosh Le'Yehovah gold band around it, and it's drawn here. And then you can get a feel for, you know, here's the breastplate with the precious stones that have the names carved in them. You've got the ephod, which is this colorful tunic, this robe. And it reminds us kind of like Joseph, right? He had a coat of many colors. This kind of looks like a coat of many colors. And Yeshua is like like Joseph because his brothers rejected him. So, you know, we start talking about reading Joseph back in Genesis. You know, you can kind of get a feel for that looking at this. And you have the other, the blue robe that is underneath here with the bells and the pomegranates on the bottom. And then you have the normal robe, the white one. And then, of course, they're not showing the trousers, the underpants that they have. But this is kind of a nice picture to help as we're reading through it. This can help you visualize all the words that we're going to be reading here for the next four or five chapters. So should we pass it around or just leave it up there for now? But we'll leave it up all night, so if you want to come and check it out. It's a really nice diagram. And they also show the orientation of the tribes because all the tents of the tribes were set up. And so you see the tribe of Judah was here on the eastern side. And you got Aaron, Nadab, and Abihu, although that was short period of time that they were there. And but Itamar, Eleazar, the other sons of Aaron that are there. And then you have all the different tribes represented. So if you're kind of imagining looking down on it, you know, from a heavenly perspective, and if you do the numbers, and if you're kind of like me and say, well, if we have 112,000 here, that would be this much area. And if we have 362,496 on this, what you do is you see it actually just like a cross. Mm-hmm. You know, from heaven, mm-hmm. And it's really pretty amazing. And when you think about Yeshua being the Lamb, this would be right in the center of it all. So as viewed from heaven, you know, it's that cross, that covenant, the Tav that we see in the Hebrew, because the ancient Tav was drawn as an X, mm-hmm. like a cross. Mm-hmm. So and of course the meaning of that is sign, seal, ownership, the covenant, the end. So
how does that compare to the cross now that they say is not?
Well,
it's
interesting because it does seem like it was acknowledged that was going to be the end of it, right? And Yeshua said, this is the end. But it was that cross that he had the three nails, the nail, right. nail, blah, 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 666. He was nailed to it, putting an end to it.
Yeah.
And so I mean, there's always going to be some kind of satanic counterfeit for everything
mm-hmm.
God does.
Right.
And so those pagan crosses, you know, Hitler had a cross too, but it had smeared edges, so it was called a swastika. But it had the cross at its core, but then it had these little flag things on the end of it. So, I mean, if you think about it like that, it's just another abomination on top of what God is doing. So, anyway, I just thought you guys might enjoy this picture. I don't have a reference for it for the radio folks if they wanted to know the name of it. So,
I'll put something up.
You can help us out with that, Rob.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, significance of the face, but there's significance that we know of the face, the east and west.
I'll tell you what I think.
Mm-hmm.
Let's hear it, Ken.
I've already shared it.
Yeah, that's good. You shared it a couple weeks ago.
Eden, when they were with God in the garden, he wants to bring us back to that.
Mm-hmm.
And he casts them out to the east. So here's our Father dwelling here, and he sent his Son. And his Son came after us. He went out the east gate to get us. They were cast out to the east. So Yeshua went out the east gate to gather us back, to come back into that garden relationship.
That's awesome.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, cool.
Yeah.
Okay.
Powerful.
What a love.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So, if we want, if anybody wants to get into like the symbolism of the tabernacle, you know, this is like our body because we have to die to ourselves, and then this is our soul getting fed by the Word of God and being guided by the Spirit, and then our spirit is where we're one with the Spirit of God. And you have three pilgrimage feasts: Passover, it's all about deliverance; Shavuot, it's all about the law and the Spirit; and then Shavuot is where you dwell and live with God. You know, and this is the image of us as well, because we are that portable tabernacle. I'd rather be a tabernacle than a temple, because tabernacles get to go around and move around all over the place. Wherever the cloud goes, that's where the tabernacle will follow. So when the pillar of cloud, God's Spirit, is telling us, hey, go to Indonesia and go visit a dude in prison, and your wife works for American Airlines, so you can make it there in 27 hours, so get on the next plane, you know, he sends people.
Mm-hmm.
And so Fernando was a tabernacle. He wasn't a temple. He wasn't sitting in a spot. He was a tabernacle that went because God sent him. And that's what we are. So we need to be like, that's what I love about the tabernacle. Of course, me being with mobility, I like
yeah,
the whole thing.
Yeah.
So, good stuff, honey.
Yeah. It took him more like 80 hours.
Was it? Well, that's true. He had some layovers. Oh, yeah. Every mode of transportation.
Boat, bus.
I'm all fair for
3 days.
I feel both ways.
In the snow.
Yeah, that's right.
Hey. He really did. It was quite a task. All right. So thank you very much, Mr. Rob. Okay. Chapter 36.
You know, just a random thought popped in my head. If you said the dimension was 150 by 75?
Yeah. In terms of feet. I mean, it has a different Hebrew cubits and all that.
Well, still, that's the same width as the Ark of Noah, and it's one-third the length. Mm-hmm. So I wonder if there's a correlation there. I don't know. It's just a random thought that popped in my head.
I was thinking about the Ark as well. And I mean, because the New Jerusalem is 1,500 miles, if you will, or I forget the certain number of stadia. They use the term stadia because they're not really associated with these, but it's like an even expanded version of that, but it's a cube. It's the same length and width and height, so it's the way it's described in the Bible. So, any volunteers?
Exodus 36. Bezalel and Oholiab and every skillful one to whom the Lord has given skill and understanding to know how to do any work in the construction of the sanctuary shall work in accordance with all that the Lord has commanded.
Moses then called Bezalel and Oholiab and every skillful one to whom the Lord had given skill, everyone whose heart was stirred to come to do the work. And they received from Moses all the freewill offerings that the Israelites had brought for doing the work on the sanctuary. They still kept bringing him freewill offerings every morning, so that all the artisans who were doing every sort of task on the sanctuary came, each from the task being performed, and said to Moses,
"The people are bringing much more than enough for doing the work that the Lord has commanded us to do."
So Moses gave command, and word was proclaimed throughout the camp.
No man or woman is to make anything else as an offering for the sanctuary.
So the people were restrained from bringing, for what they had already brought was more than enough to do all the work. All those with skill among the workers made the tabernacle with 10 curtains. They were made of fine twisted linen, and blue, purple, and crimson yarns, with cherubim skillfully worked into them. The length of each curtain was 28 cubits. And the width of each curtain, 4 cubits. All the curtains were of the same size. He joined 5 curtains to one another, and the other 5 curtains he joined to one another. He made loops of blue on the edge of the outermost curtain of the first set. Likewise, he made them on the edge of the outermost curtain of the second set. He made 50 loops on the one curtain, and he made 50 loops on the edge of the curtain that was in the second set. The loops were opposite one another. And he made 50 clasps of gold, and joined the curtains one to the other with clasps, so the tabernacle was one whole. He also made curtains of goat's hair for a tent over the tabernacle. He made 11 curtains. The length of each curtain was 30 cubits, and the width of each curtain 4 cubits. The 11 curtains were of the same size. He joined 5 curtains by themselves, and 6 curtains by themselves. He made 50 loops on the edge of the outermost curtain of the one set, and 50 loops on the edge of the other connecting curtain. He made 50 clasps of bronze to join the tent together so that it might be one whole. And he made for the tent a covering of tanned ram skins and an outer covering of fine leather. Then he made the upright frames for the tabernacle of acacia wood. 10 cubits was the length of a frame, and 1.5 cubits the width of each frame. Each frame had 2 pegs for fitting together. He did this for all the frames of the tabernacle. The frames for the tabernacle he made in this way: 20 frames for the south side, and he made 40 bases of silver under the 20 frames, 2 bases under the first frame for its 2 pegs, and 2 bases under the next frame for its 2 pegs.
For the second side of the tabernacle, on the north side, he made 20 frames, and there 40 bases of silver, 2 bases under the first frame, and 2 bases under the next frame. For the rear of the tabernacle, westward, he made 6 frames. He made 2 frames for corners of the tabernacle in the rear. They were separate beneath, but joined at the top at the first ring. He made 2 of them in this way for the 2 corners. There were 8 frames with their bases of silver, 16 bases, under every frame 2 bases. He made bars of acacia wood, 5 for the frames of the one side of the tabernacle, and 5 bars for the frames of the other side of the tabernacle, and 5 bars for the frames of the tabernacle at the rear westward. He made the middle bar to pass through from end to end halfway up the frames. And he overlaid the frames with gold, and made rings of gold for them to hold the bars, and overlaid the bars with gold. He made the curtain of blue, purple, and crimson yarns, and fine twisted linen, with cherubim skillfully worked into it. For it he made 4 pillars of acacia, and overlaid them with gold. Their hooks were of gold, and he cast for them 4 bases of silver. He also made a screen for the entrance to the tent of blue, purple, and crimson yarns, and fine twisted linen, embroidered with needlework, and its 5 pillars with their hooks. He overlaid their capitals and their bases with gold, but their 5 bases were of bronze.
All right. Observations, thoughts?
Those last ones had bronze bases. Everything else had silver. I don't know what the significance of that is.
My observation is everything being joined together as a unit, so you see it all come together as one. You know where to be. It's just the unity that's in here.
That's good. That's very good.
Well, what church project have you ever heard of where they actually had to beg the people to stop giving?
Yeah.
I mean, please stop. Okay. And he says we have more than enough to complete the task.
You know, and I love the comment you made earlier, Rob, speaking about the idea of a possible second exodus and a wealth transfer. And if the prophets say that the woman flees into the wilderness to the place prepared for her for 1260 days, and the woman that they're talking about are the people who are in Judah that are told to flee, because that's what Yeshua said, that all when you see the abomination of desolation standing in the holy place, as written or spoken of by the prophet Daniel, let all who are in Judea flee. So there's going to be a wilderness kind of place built, apparently, using this mindset, that at some point when that abomination shows up, whoever the faithful are in Judea are going to flee and go to that place in the wilderness that's being prepared. Well, if there is more than enough for that tabernacle experience the first time around out in the wilderness, there's a good chance there'll be more than enough the second time around. Mm-hmm. And if that is a 20-year period, like what we talked about with Jacob's trouble and all that, it sounds like we could have 16 and a half years to be working on it while for Brother Judah, or the people who are in the land called Judah, that we call Israel today, when they have to leave the land. Because the Bible is very clear, they will have to leave. So that's kind of exciting.
Mm-hmm.
If you like details.
You see in Scripture, several times, like in Ecclesiastes 3:26 and Proverbs 13:22, that the wealth is always stored up. The sinner's task is to store up wealth for the righteous.
Yes.
It's your task.
Wow. Everywhere. Good.
Can you say that again?
Ecclesiastes 3:26 and Proverbs 13, it talks about that the sinner's task is for storing up wealth for the righteous. So he tasked the sinner for storing up the wealth for the righteous.
Mm. Kind of like Egypt giving up.
Yep. Well, okay, now, how does Egypt get the gold in the first place?
Plunder.
How did Egypt get the gold in the first place?
Plunder.
And slavery.
Because Joseph came down there and told them about the visions of Pharaoh. Well, exactly. Pharaoh had these dreams and Joseph was there. God gave Egypt the wealth to begin with.
Right.
And if it weren't for Joseph, Egypt would have been just like Babylon or any other nation and wouldn't have anything and they would have died. So God was the one that put Egypt in a place to get that gold in the first place. And it was Joseph's plan when Egypt started selling all the grain that everybody needed. That's when all the gold came in the first place.
It says even in Isaiah 60 about the wealth of the Gentiles coming to you. Isaiah 60 talks about the same thing. You can just research it out. It's their silver and their gold with them, you know, it's going to be given.
But God is providing for them for this whole thing, for this tabernacle way.
Probably while Jacob was still hanging out wondering where Joseph was.
Probably from in the beginning.
Yeah, well,
yeah.
From before
they were
created.
Yeah.
It's amazing when you think about it, because it wasn't Egypt's gold, it was God's gold. He gave Egypt the plan to get the gold.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I find it interesting.
He knew the end. Right.
That's right.
So this is amazing.
And what was he doing? He was doing it for his glory, because
exactly.
He was going to be glorified by his tabernacle.
Yeah. I find it interesting the time of the transfer. The time of the transfer was actually on the way out from a place where it probably could have been from Egypt into the wilderness. It was when, so what do we do with this? It's a place in which when we're ready and when the timing will probably be sometime in which we are already on the way out, where it's not going to be, hey, I can use it for snow skiing, you know? Or, you know, I can give away a certain amount, I'm going to have, you know, it's not for our comfort as much as it's going to be used toward building what Father has. And I think that if it came early, because I think a lot of times, maybe in living in, for me, I can only speak for me living, oh, that sounds great, I can hardly wait, because then I can have, you know, this comfort, yet I can give away and I can do all this stuff for Yehovah. But it's actually going to be in a position where it's very specific. And so I think that our hearts are going to have to be in a lot different place. You know, that's what he's changed trading us for, because I'd love for it to happen now.
Yeah.
You know, bring it now! But it's going to be when I don't need it. You know, when it's just, okay, give it away as fast as it comes in.
Good. Any other thoughts? We move on to chapter 37.
Exodus 37. Bezalel made the ark of acacia wood. It was 2.5 cubits long, 1.5 cubits wide, and 1.5 cubits high. He overlaid it with pure gold inside and outside, and made a molding of gold around it. He cast for it 4 rings of gold for its 4 feet, 2 rings on its one side and 2 rings on its other side. He made poles of acacia wood and overlaid them with gold, and put the poles into the rings on the sides of the ark to carry the ark. He made a mercy seat of pure gold. 2.5 cubits was its length, and 1.5 cubits its width. He made 2 cherubim of hammered gold. At the 2 ends of the mercy seat he made them, 1 cherub at the one end, and 1 cherub at the other end. Of 1 piece with the mercy seat he made the cherubim at its 2 ends. The cherubim spread out their wings above, overshadowing the mercy seat with their wings. They faced one another. The faces of the cherubim were turned toward the mercy seat. He also made the table of acacia wood, 2 cubits long, 1 cubit wide, and 1.5 cubits high. He overlaid it with pure gold, and made a molding of gold around it. He made around it a rim, 1 handbreadth wide, and made a molding of gold around the rim. He cast for it 4 rings of gold, and fastened the rings to the 4 corners at its 4 legs. The rings that held the poles used for carrying the table were close to the rim. He made the poles of acacia wood to carry the table, and overlaid them with gold. And he made the vessels of pure gold that were to be on the table, its plates and dishes for incense, and its bowls and flagons with which to pour drink offerings.
Do you mind if we stop there so we can talk about the Ark of the Covenant, and then we can move on with the menorah next? Okay, who's got some insight into this Ark of the Covenant that they would like to share? Because we've talked about this a lot in the past, about these 2 angels with their wings touching, and what's that?
They're
mighty angels. What's going on here? What's up with these? What's this image?
Aren't they there to protect it?
They're restraining
yes.
Satan.
Oh, that's a good one. Explain. Elaborate. No, elaborate. We haven't gone through this with a lot of people, so I'm happy to discuss it. Okay. First of all,
the box is wood.
What kind of wood?
Acacia.
What's acacia in Hebrew?
Shittim,
right?
It's
shittim. That enthusiasm. Last syllable. The last level.
Shittim.
Okay. Now, one of the amazing things about the Hebrew language is the fact that the letters, there are no numbers, that you have letters, and the letters are the numbers. But the letters are pictures, and the pictures have meanings. And so sometimes when you look at the pictures, you can get a sense for what does this word mean. And sometimes you can look at words and add up the number of the letters. And it's not numerology we're talking about here. It's just this is one of the characteristics of a word. And so if you take each letter and you add the value of that letter up, you can get the weight or the glory of that particular word. And so sometimes words that have the same weight might have an interesting relationship that's worth looking into. And so there's not always a direct correlation or association, but it's fun to do that. So in Hebrew, and I don't have any... you guys would probably could benefit from Hebrew alphabet. There's one printed out right beside the thing. If you wouldn't mind. Thank you. So this...
My car.
This Shittim... It's Shin, Het, Yod, Mem Sofit. Okay, this is the type of wood. And again, what is the status of wood? Is it dead or is it alive?
Dead.
Okay, it's dead, but it used to be alive, right?
Mm-hmm.
When it was before, while it was planted and had its roots in the ground, it was alive. But when you cut it, it's dead. And so it's made out of dead wood. And that's why a lot of the idols, you know, when the prophets mock the idols, why would you carve something out with your hand? You worship it and bow down to it, and then you turn the rest of it into firewood. Why don't you just use it all for firewood? You know, it's worthless. It can't talk. It can't speak. You know, idolatry is silly. So what we see is all throughout the tabernacle, the use of this material called shittim. And we also talked about how out in the bronze, when you have the bronze, the word for bronze is nachoshet. And the word for serpent is nachash. So you can see kind of a play on words. The bronze serpent, you know, nachash, nachoshet. You see how they're played. So what you see is you have this shittim wood. It's covered with the bronze on the outside. And what when we have the bronze altar, the brazen, there's a fire. It's a perpetual fire all the time. It's under fire. So we see the bronze is related to the serpent in judgment. But this shittim here is really what's interesting. So let's take a look at and see what shittim. Let's look at the letters. And so you got your alphabet there. The sheen. What do we see is what is the value or the number associated with the sheen?
300.
Okay. And the tet.
Nine.
Okay, because it's the ninth letter of the alphabet, so it's like number nine. Like in our case, we would say, like, we have the alphabet, they have the aleph bet in the Hebrew language, and the alpha is, or aleph is the first, like our letter A is the first, B is second, C is third, that type of thing. So then we have the yod, or yud, some people say, it's shaped like an arm, right? You see how it's like that?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and it's the tenth letter of the Hebrew alphabet, which gives it a ten. It means your hand, your work. So you think about the scriptures, with a mighty hand and an outstretched arm, blood endures forever. Right? You got two yods right there, two hands. Yod. That's a short version of saying Adonai or the Lord, because he's with a mighty hand and an outstretched arm. And to whom has the arm of the Lord been revealed? He grew up before him like a tender shoot, but out of root, out of dry ground. We didn't recognize him according to the prophet Isaiah. So this is powerful. What do you do with your arm? You lift stuff. You work. You know, if I bend my arm, I'm working. I'm lifting up the chair, even though it's a Shabbat. Give me a look.
Up.
So,
oh,
anyway, y'all aren't going to kill me. Right? We just read that, right?
Good.
Okay, and then the mem.
That's number 40.
See this mem? Yep, it's number 40.
Now, what are some of the words associated with the men? I like it. It's nice to have group participation.
Water.
Okay. All right, so we think about water. What are some of the other words? Because we're going to tie this together here.
Chaos.
Messiah, okay. Does that make sense? Chaos, water, Messiah? So you think about a river. Like you have a stream, you have nice, cool water you can drink, okay? And that's the mem. And like the word for heavens is mayim, which is literally the waters.
Water.
Mayim, shemayim is heavens. So heaven is associated with water, and it has two mems in there. So, but when if it's had a terrible rainfall, then the water is like Grand Rapids. It's mighty, and what does it do? It cuts through the land. You know, it's like it causes erosion. You know, it's powerful. It piles through there. So that's like chaos. It's like bringing destruction. But we also know that Yeshua, he says living water is going to come out of our bellies. We're going to be crushing through the evil and knocking them out. You know, we're going to be conquering the king for the kingdom. That's right. Give them some uppercuts and some spiritual sidekicks. And anyway, when you add all these up, I'm just giving you a sense of the men, the water, the Messiah, the strong. And when it's in the Sophic position, if it was a regular men, it would look like that.
Mm-hmm.
But if it's in the Sophic position, it means it's strong. You know, like you have a capital letters for the beginning of our names. Well, in the Hebrew, five letters have a different shape when it's at the end of the word, and the mem is one of those five. And so, anyway, that's kind of a lot to say. When I just want you to do add up some numbers. So what does that equal?
359.
Okay? Now, there's another word in the Hebrew that also is 359. And I'm not going to tell anybody what it is just yet. But I'll draw it in red, so that'll give you a hint.
Machines?
Head?
Umbrella.
Noon Sophie. Okay? Sheen, Ted, Noon Sophie. Okay? So now let's add this up so we can do the math and prove it. They're functionally equivalent, or there could be an association here. So what do we say to Sheen? 300.
300.
The Ted?
9.
And the Noon?
50.
Okay? And so let's take a look at this word. What are some of the meanings for the sheen?
Destroy.
Okay. And you see how it looks? It's like three prongs that come up like this, right? And in the ancient Paleo Hebrew, it looks like a tooth. And what do you do with your teeth?
You devour.
You destroy. You consume. And that's why it was drawn as a tooth, and that's why it means to like destroy. Kind of silly, right? But does it help remember, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, okay, that's group assignment. Everybody, do a sheen.
All right.
You're on your way to learning Hebrew. Say hallelujah. You're already speaking. Look at it. All right. So then this tet. You see how it's kind of drawn like something like a hug. You know, but what are some of the
surround,
right? And to kind of, so you're thinking about something that's destroying and it's kind of surrounding, right? But now, what does this mean?
Life.
Eternal activities. Life. But in this case, yeah, Rob said it. When it's in the Sophit, it's the strongest expression. So it's like eternal life. So this thing, it destroys and surrounds your eternal life.
Wow.
Well, who would do that?
Satan.
The adversary, right? So Satan, what we're saying is, he's functionally equivalent to this shatim, this dead wood. And that's why God was very specific. Because let me tell you, it's a lot cheaper and easier probably to get cedars from Lebanon than it is to have shatim. Why did God pick shatim? Specifically, over and over again, he says, shatim. There's something to this. And so people might go, oh no, they're talking about Satan being in heaven. Well, read the book of Job. What's going on? Job, Satan's going back and forth between heaven and earth, and he goes up in front of God's face and saying, hey, yeah, well, you're protecting him. That's why he hasn't cursed you. Why don't you take some of this stuff away from him?
Well, he was also described as the anointed cherub that covered the throne.
That's right.
Or guarded, some say, but.
He was there.
He's a cover.
He's fallen from there, right? So now, how does this all tie in to the Ark of the Covenant, right? This is where we're getting into this So we see that. Also, we saw that the showbread, the table of the showbread, was made out of shittim, covered with gold, right? And the gold really represents. Think about it like an M&M. You got the chocolate in the middle, right? And then you have the candy coating on the outside. That's what this gold was. It was like a candy coating. But you really can't see that there's any chocolate unless you broke it or something or eat it. You know. So if the tables were completely clad with this gold. And so we've talked before about how that table supports the 12 loaves of bread, whereas Yeshua represents all 12 tribes of Israel because he's calling us in together, and he's the bread of life that has come from heaven. And we're supposed to eat the bread and feed on the word of God. And he calls himself, this is my body that's been broken for you. So we see that there in the middle of the tabernacle. But we have the menorah right beside it, the seven-branch lampstand. It's not candlesticks. It's a lamp that holds oil. You burn the oil. There's no wax involved. There's no paper wick. It's a lampstand, and it's shedding light. And that's the Spirit, because without you, the Spirit guides us into all truth. And Yeshua says, "I'm the way, the truth, and the life." And so that light is shining on the bread, but that bread is subduing the table. That foundation is kind of there with Satan, right? But he's being subdued. We saw that also out in the bronze altar, because the lamb was on top of the bronze all the time, subduing the Shittim, Satan, who was constantly being burned. So even in the death of the Lamb, we see Satan being conquered.
Yeah.
So you go into the Holy of Holies, and what you have is this Ark of the Covenant, and it's made out of Shittim, which we're associating with Satan, and he is an anointed cherub. A cherubim is more than one cherub. Instead of saying cherubs, we say cherubim in the Hebrew. And so what you have is this box-shaped angel down here that we call Satan, clad with gold. He's been subdued. And what does he have to hang on to? The Ten Commandments, right?
Mm-hmm.
He's got Aaron's staff
and
a box of manna. So he's having to carry around all the miraculous things God is doing. But God now has this mercy seat that's on top of it. And I'll do a terrible drawing, but now you have two angels here with their wings touching above the top of it like this, and their kind of faces looking down on it, right? And it's this idea of kind of this restrainer, right? Because it's angels, like in military, you use tanks to fight tanks. You use airplanes to fight airplanes, you know. Angels are what subdues and fights other angels. If we try to go to fight with an angel, probably you're not going to make it. You know, they have access to a little more. We need an angel to help us. We need God to help us. But what I'm saying here is, if one-third of the angels fell, that one-third is represented because they did it at Satan's calling, Lucifer's calling, and he was kicked and fell out of heaven, right? So there's the one-third that fell. But these other two-thirds that are represented by the two other cherubim that are touching the wings, they are restraining this evil one. And they didn't fall. They're standing in the presence of God, because this is where God manifests. Now, where do you think Yeshua is going to be sitting when he comes back to rule and reign from Jerusalem? He's going to have a seat on top of Satan's head. And the two angels are going to be right there with him saying, "Hallelujah."
Mm-hmm.
And he's going to be, this seat's a little warm. That's all right. And, I really think that that's what we're looking at here. So we see Satan, even though he's in the midst of the temple, and he's eventually going to get thrown out. And that's when Rob comes in and take over the teaching. When all those rest of those angels come and fall. But I'm telling you, I believe very firmly, the picture we see in heaven is the complete subduing and submission of Satan by the Lamb and the angels and God's plan. And that's why he hates us, because he sees that in us, because we're portable tabernacles. And we, in the image of God, show his destruction. And so the Shittim, or Shittim, as Rob said a minute ago, I like Shittim, it's Hebrew, but that dead wood is no power over us. He's subdued. So another amazing, you know, representation of what's going on in this tabernacle. Make sense? Okay. Questions, thoughts, more Hebrew words? Okay. All right, so I guess you can continue on now, Michael, with verse 17.
17.
He also made the lampstand of pure gold. The base and the shaft of the lampstand were made of hammered work. Its cups, its calyxes, and its petals were of one piece with it.
There were six branches going out of its sides, three branches of the lampstand out of one side of it, and three branches of the lampstand out of the other side of it. Three cups shaped like almond blossoms, each with calyx and petals on one branch, and three cups shaped like almond blossoms, each with calyx and petals on the other branch. So for the six branches going out of the lampstand. On the lampstand itself, there were four cups shaped like almond blossoms, each with its calyxes and petals. There was a calyx of one piece with it under the first pair of branches, a calyx of one piece with it under the next pair of branches, and a calyx of one piece with it under the last pair of branches. Their calyxes and their branches were of one piece with it, the whole of it one hammered piece of pure gold. He made it seven lamps, and its snuffers, and its trays of pure gold. He made it and all its utensils of a talent of pure gold. He made the altar of incense of acacia wood, one cubit long and one cubit wide. It was square and was two cubits high. Its horns were of one piece with it. He overlaid it with pure gold, its top and its sides all around, and its horns. And he made for it a molding of gold all around, and made two golden rings for it under its molding, on two opposite sides of it, to hold the poles with which to carry it. And he made the poles of acacia wood, and overlaid them with gold. He made the holy anointing oil also, and the pure fragrant incense blended as by the perfumer.
All right. Any observations on the menorah? Remember earlier we were talking about traditions and counterfeits and things like that? And Amanda had a good question about the cross and, you know, how that relates to the Tav in the ancient Hebrew. Well, I've never personally seen an almond blossom, but it's very prominently described here on the menorah, right? Every branch of the menorah has these almond blossoms. But what I understand is an almond blossom is a pretty little flower, and it's kind of shaped like this. It has like six... It has like six petals on it. And that's a lot different than the six hard edges of a star. Whereas, so it's almost like this is what God was representing in the tabernacle through the use of, and in Aaron's staff budding, it was an almond. It produced almonds. I think one day we're going to have some almond milk from that. I think this is the counterfeit of what God intended. Because God's picture is of the, and if you think about it, it has nice round edges. It's symbolic of, you know, spring and a promise. Because I think the almond tree is one of the first ones to blossom in the spring. So you know you're coming out of the wintertime. And so, you know, I can't help but wonder if there's some sort of a counterfeit there, because it is a six-petaled flower. Because, you know, God's talking to us through the use of almond blossoms, not Chinese thorn stars. Yeah, or rafam or whatever it's called. So yeah, we're going to talk about plagues and stuff too. So we talk about the Egyptian gods because they fall. But anyway, I just wanted just to share that, especially because you brought up the thing about the cross and the Tav, so it goes both ways. And we talked last week about this oil, this very special oil. It's called Kadosh Shemin Mashiach, is what it says in Hebrew. And it's relating to Kadosh being holy, and the Shemin is the oil, which has Shem and Nun Sofit, is how you spell it. So it would be like the name of everlasting life, and it's Mashiach. That's anointing, but it literally, is, when we say Yeshua HaMashiach, Yeshua, the anointed one. That's what Mashiach is, the one anointed. And so this oil is some very special oil. All right. Any other thoughts on that? We'll move on to chapter 38.
I'm pretty interested in metallurgy, and the thing that strikes me as so exceedingly interesting is that gold, if you pour it, it's gold is really soft. It's very dense, so it's really heavy. If you pour it, the branches of the menorah would just sag because of their own weight. But he specifies that it needs to be pounded.
Yeah.
And when you work, one of the ways that you harden metal is to work harden it, which is by pounding it. And that makes it hard enough that it may not sag because of its own weight. I don't know. I've never, don't know anybody that's had enough gold to give that a try to find out.
It's only 75
pounds.
Everyone, give it here. Yeah, well, give me your gold.
No pun intended, but one of the things that strikes me about that is literally how do you pound out the almond blossom flowers? You know, it said it was made of hammered, I mean, you were just one chunk of gold, and all of a sudden you're like, it's incredible. I mean, I can't imagine the skill that would have
taken.
These
are really skilled craftsmen. Yeah. When he said that, they really are.
And it didn't leak, right? Because you have to put oil in it. If you have one little crack and it starts leaking out, I mean, it has to be structurally sound because it had a function as well.
How big was it?
It's probably as tall as we are. 66 feet tall. But I don't know.
We're a hammered piece, too.
That's one big piece of gold. He hammers us good.
They make a mold for the gold, and the molds are held together. I do ceramic, so... If you have molds, you strap them tight, then when you pour it in, they're clean. But they would have to take it out while it was, I don't know, maybe not. They probably pounded the line, because even though the molds are tight, there's still a slight line where the pieces were cooked. So they would have to pound that part out to smooth it out and make it all of one piece.
Yeah.
Once it hardens up in that mold, it's going to hold it on light.
Okay.
This had to have taken a long time to do. Yeah. Do we have a duration in here somewhere? Do we haven't read yet?
Well, the only thing that the timing of it is mentioned here in the next couple of chapters. It opens up when all this took place.
Hmm.
So I believe it was less than a year. Because we're going to read it here in just a few minutes on chapter 40, which this is what really got me jazzed up. Yehovah said to Moshe, on the first day of the first month, you are to set up the tabernacle, the tent of meeting. And so this is. It was in the second year. I think it later on it says that it was in the second. Just for that one verse. So if you think about it, Israel gets delivered, you know, and then 50 days later, which we see the 50s all throughout the tabernacle, right? The 50 loops and everything. So you got 50 days, and then there's 50 years in the Jubilee cycle, and it's too amazing.
Hmm.
But anyway, you get to the 50th day after the seventh weekly Sabbath. The day after that Sabbath was Shavuot, and that's when the Ten Commandments were given. And then Moses did his going up and down the mountain seven times bit. And then that's when he came back with a plan, and they start working on the plan. And then here it is at the beginning of the first day of the month of the second year. Well, they left, you know, in the middle of the first month of the first year. So this all took place probably, I would estimate, over a 9 or a 10 month period of time. It was ready for Moses to do the finishing touches on the furnishings. So I think it would have taken pretty close to a year to do it. But I mean, when you got 2 million people with all these skills and all that gold and everything else, what else are they going to do?
Right.
I mean, they're not having quail roasts. You know, they don't have to worry about their food just being provided every day.
Right.
So.
And they're clearly already, like, willing. If they already have an abundance of materials, they're clearly willing of their time as well to, invest in making sure that what God has told them to do, that it is on point. And so, I don't know, this resonates within me that, that's what we should be doing with our lives, being willing to focus on His Word and what He wants to achieve, what we want in our lives, to make sure that our menorahs are not sagging.
No sagging
menorahs. It says that the Lord, you know how it says that the Lord is going to work out all things for the good of those who love Him and are called according to His purpose, right? Well, I mean, this is a situation where everybody was groaning, complaining because they were making bricks and doing all these slavery-related work, these tasks in Egypt. Well, it might have made for them to have really strong, skilled hands that now God was able to take the skills and the strength and the things that they learned, and they could work hard for long periods of time to do all this, to go out there and collect all that wood, cut it up, get sand it down, and,
yeah.
and pound
yeah.
all that gold.
If they were in Ramses, they were used to making ornate things for the Egyptian gods.
Yeah, but also like having like feeling very worn down by the whole task that they were given in Egypt because it wasn't for, you know, Jehovah. Like, it was for their stupid gods that aren't real. And so now they're in this desert, and God is providing for them, and now it's like, oh, I get it. Like, God.
Yeah. We're doing it joyfully now for our deliverer.
Yeah. God is doing some muscle building for them to go in and shoot
them. Slavery. Yeah. But think about this, too. From a slavery perspective, God made reparation because they got paid on the way out.
Yeah.
But then what they do with
got
that money?
First.
They gave it back to him.
Yeah,
and then he restored their joy. I mean, it's amazing when you think about it.
Because
they were using their gifts for his glory, so they didn't care about giving it back. Instead of like it's, I see it like today in doing work in corporate America.
It's deferred compensation.
Yeah, but when you can turn your gifts into bring, it just makes your life come alive. You know,
yeah.
you want to get it back.
So wonderful.
And what Daryl's talking about is kind of to me boils down to faith, you know. I mean, he made manna and water before. We're going to have hidden manna coming up, so to overcome.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's everything else is cycled.
Right.
You know,
yeah.
he's going to provide.
I'm going to put an aerial view from Google Earth of that location where they were, because I think it'll help to just show the where they were doing all of this. Because it's kind of neat, because when they came out of Egypt and crossed the Red Sea, they actually kind of had to do a run around this mountain range, because they were on the east side of the Mount Sinai mountain range. So all their old paths is way on the other side of this mountain range, way out of sight. I don't know what's to the east, but I know the area right at the base of Mount Sinai is a very large staging area where you could easily envision 2 million people doing this construction project.
Yeah.
They were camped to the east of the mount?
East of Mount Sinai, yes. On the east side.
I'm glad you said that, because I just pictured that they were on the other side. I didn't know that.
No, because they came from Egypt, and they can't come around like this. And I wish I had the picture to show you, because it's pretty cool. And what's really wild is if you look on the Google Earth image, you've got the mountain range here. You've got this big area here where they, even to this day, the altar for the golden calf is still there. You can still see that there.
Really?
It's been fenced off, and you can't physically get to it because it's got barbed wire fence and stuff around it now. But on the west side,
it's in Saudi Arabia, not Mount Sinai as we know it.
It's not in.
It's just not on the Sinai Peninsula. It's actually in Saudi Arabia.
Right. On the west side, there's a valley, and in that valley on Google Earth, you can see what looks like a very, very large serpent-shaped skeletal remains of something.
Well, I was going to say, would you like to pull that up, and we can put it on the TV for everybody?
Google
we have
Earth.
A computer.
Yeah,
I think you loaded it on there, because we talked about
I could
something
find
similar
it,
before.
Probably.
I have a little map in my Bible.
Yeah. Well, we can try it later. I'll see if I can do it on the iPad here while we're
okay.
talking.
Okay. Well, because we have a cable that comes to the TV
if
I can see it. Okay, any other thoughts on that as we move into finishing up chapter 38, I think it was?
Well, that's the chapter.
What are we going to do about this other one?
We're going to read it right now.
Yeah.
38? You want it, honey?
Oh.
The whole chapter 38?
Okay.
Because we're going to just go right on through. We're going to move into the portion that's called Tikkuni.
Exodus 38. He made the altar of burnt offering also of acacia wood. It was 5 cubits long and 5 cubits wide. It was square and 3 cubits high. He made horns for it on its 4 corners. Its horns were of 1 piece with it, and he overlaid it with bronze. He made all the utensils of the altar, the pots, the shovels, the basins, the forks, and the fire pans. All its utensils he made of bronze. He made for the altar a grating, a network of bronze under its ledge, extending halfway down. He cast 4 rings on the 4 corners of the bronze grating to hold the poles. He made the poles of acacia wood and overlaid them with bronze. And he put the poles through the rings on the sides of the altar to carry it with him. He made it hollow with boards. He made the basin of bronze with its stand of bronze from the mirrors of the women who served at the entrance to the tent of meeting. He made the court. For the south side, the hangings of the court were of fine twisted linen, 100 cubits long. Its 20 pillars and their 20 bases were of bronze, but the hooks of the pillars and their bands were of silver. For the north side, there were hangings 100 cubits long. Its 20 pillars and their 20 bases were of bronze, but the hooks of the pillars and their bands were of silver. For the west side, there were hangings 50 cubits long, with 10 pillars and 10 bases. The hooks of the pillars and their bands were of silver. And for the front to the east, 50 cubits. The hangings for one side of the gate were 15 cubits, with 3 pillars and 3 bases. And so for the other side, on each side of the gate of the court were hangings of 15 cubits, with 3 pillars and 3 bases. All the hangings around the court were of fine twisted linen. The bases for the pillars were of bronze, but the hooks of the pillars and their bands were of silver. The overlaying of their capitals was also of silver, and all the pillars of the court were banded with silver. The screen for the entrance to the court was embroidered with needlework in blue, purple, and crimson yarns, and fine twisted linen. It was 20 cubits long, and along the width of it, 5 cubits high, corresponding to the hangings of the court. There were 4 pillars. Their 4 bases were of bronze, their hooks of silver, and the overlaying of their capitals and their bands of silver. All the pegs for the tabernacle and for the court all around were of bronze. These are the records of the tabernacle of the covenant, which were drawn up at the commandment of Moses, the work of the Levites being under the direction of Ithamar, son of the priest Aaron. Bezalel, son of Uri, son of Hur, of the tribe of Judah, made all that the Lord commanded Moses. And with him was Aholiab, son of Ahisamach, of the tribe of Dan, engraver, designer, and embroiderer in blue, purple, and crimson yarns, and in fine linen. All the gold that was used for the work, in all the construction of the sanctuary, the gold from the offering was 29 talents and 730 shekels, measured by the sanctuary shekel. The silver from those of the congregation who were counted was 100 talents and 1,775 shekels, measured by the sanctuary shekel. A bika a head, that is half a shekel, measured by the sanctuary shekel, for everyone who was counted in the census, from 20 years old and upward, for 603,550 men. The 100 talents of silver were for casting the bases of the sanctuary and the bases of the curtain. 100 bases for the 100 talents, a talent for a base. Of the 1,775 shekels, he made hooks for the pillars, and overlaid their capitals and made bands for them. The bronze that was contributed was 70 talents and 2,400 shekels. With it he made the bases for the entrance of the tent of meeting, the bronze altar and the bronze grating for it, and all the utensils of the altar, the bases all around the court and the bases of the gate of the court, all the pegs of the tabernacle and all the pegs around the court.
All right.
Wow. It's really interesting because the bronze overlaid machine, and bronze is a picture of judgment.
Mm-hmm. The bronze really, overlaid what?
The shittim, what is it? The acacia wood. The acacia wood. So that's, you're right on point with that. That's mm-hmm. interesting judgment.
Mm-hmm.
Overlaying that.
This is the, I don't know if you can see it here, this clearing right here. Right there. This is where they crossed the Red Sea here. This is the mountain range and Mount Sinai is right here. So this large area right here to the east of the mountain range is where they were doing this building project. Right there.
Wow.
Can
cool.
you zoom out?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, it's on the...
That's really cool. You, I want you to go later on and where I told you we went at Kadesh Barnea and found all those burial grounds and stuff.
Hmm.
Oh, yeah.
And the sukkahs.
Yeah, but I would like to put that up on the TV.
Yeah,
so yeah, we can
see it real good that way. Anything leap off the pages of anyone regarding this? I think there's a tremendous principle here. It's one of accountability. And I think it's amazing, you know, because Beit Salel, he was the project manager, right? He did all... He was... If
says he did all the work, but of course he was in charge of getting the work done. So a lot of leaders get credit when everybody else does it. But what we see going on here is God also had an accountant.
Mm-hmm.
He used Ithamar, right? Was it Ithamar?
Mm-hmm.
And he was the one who was instructed by God to go and make sure that everything was accounted for. So what we see is you have a separation of who controls and accounts for the money versus who is executing the plan. And this is very healthy because it keeps it creates a scenario where that one person doesn't have control of everything.
Mm-hmm.
Because once you have that, that's when it goes. And that's why it's good when if you're dealing with large volumes of money like this and valuable things, that somebody's there to keep tabs on it to make sure that, you know, fingers aren't dipping into that pie, so to speak. So, and I just love how the detail. I mean, again, you know, when you look at how much gold it was, it says 29 talents, 730 shekels. Now, a shekel is literally like this, a little coin. I mean, they counted up to the little coin. 730. It wasn't, oh, it was about 700 or nearly 800. It was 730. I mean, he was very precise, very accurate with his counting. And that total amount here in my Bible says it was 1,930 pounds. That's nearly a ton of gold,
wow,
if you think about it. I mean, that's a lot of very valuable, expensive building materials. Literally building materials in this case, in the New Jerusalem, what we talked about. And then this thing with the silver, it was 6,650 pounds of silver. But yet, you know, so that sounds like just a tremendous, I mean, that's like three tons of silver, more than three tons of silver. Yeah.
Yeah, mine says 7,545 pounds of silver.
Yeah.
Which sounds like an overwhelming amount
of
silver.
That's a lot of silver.
But it was only one beka per person, a half a shekel, a fifth of an ounce.
Yeah, 2 million.
So you can see a little bit of effort from a lot of people can yield a huge, result
from a lot.
Yeah, because a half a shekel is only like,
it's like a tiny coin.
Yeah, teeny.
Wow.
So,
one says the weight of gold was one ton, and the weight of silver was 3 3/4 tons.
Yep, that's right.
Wow.
That's a lot. But they had one guy who was in charge of keeping up with it in terms of accounting for it, you know?
How do they weigh it out there?
Very carefully.
If they can build a tabernacle, they can weigh a piece of metal.
That's true.
There was the other guy that made the scale.
Yeah.
He's in the apocryphal text.
How
do
they move it?
Or a bunch of people taking
work.
Yeah.
I think you were saying it must be accountability.
Once it was up in production, exactly right. Exactly right. But yeah, you're right. Because, with Bezalel being the guy, the go-to guy, the one who was overseeing this project, a little bit of pride could keep in if that was gold was under his control and he's like, Moses has to come to me. And, you know, you could see where there's an opportunity for pride. Now, of course, they're just so excited, I think. You know, they've come out of this Egyptian system. They're getting fed every day. They're out in the desert. They're seeing a pillar of cloud in their face. And, you know, we're talking about it being hot in the desert. One of you guys mentioned something about the desert heat. But I'm thinking that it was like a canopy, like a protected canopy, you know, because you could get underneath that cloud and it'd still be, you know, 90 degrees outside, but you're not 90 degrees and the sun pounding down on you. And at nighttime, the desert can be very cold, right, because there's no atmosphere to regulate or moderate the climate. So with the pillar of fire there at night, it kind of held in some heat, kept them warm at night. So they weren't too hot in the day, they weren't too cold at night, and they were always in his presence, and they're doing this amazing construction project. You know, and I've never encountered anything, you know, that would resemble something like this. So maybe one day we will. But anyway, just that principle of accountability. And you do, when you feel like you have control of all the money, and everybody has to come to you, and you've got this big assignment, it could easily go to your head. So.
All right, chapter 39. We only have two chapters left.
Exodus 39. Of the blue, purple, and crimson yarns, they made finely worked vestments for ministering in the holy place. They made the sacred vestments for Aaron, as the Lord had commanded Moses. He made the ephod of gold, of blue, purple, and crimson yarns, and of fine twisted linen. Gold leaf was hammered out and cut into threads to work into the blue, purple, and crimson yarns, and into the fine twisted linen in skilled design. They made for the ephod shoulder pieces, joined to it at its two edges. The decorated band on it was of the same materials and workmanship, of gold, of blue, purple, and crimson yarns, and of fine twisted linen, as the Lord had commanded Moses. The onyx stones were prepared, enclosed in settings of gold filigree, and engraved like the engravings of a signet, according to the names of the sons of Israel. He set them on the shoulder pieces of the ephod to be stones of remembrance for the sons of Israel, as the Lord had commanded Moses. He made the breastpiece in skilled work, like the work of the ephod of gold, of blue, purple, and crimson yarns, and of fine twisted linen. It was square. The breastpiece was made double, a span in length and a span in width when doubled. They set in it four rows of stones. A row of carnelian, chrysolite, and emerald was the first row, and the second row, a turquoise, a sapphire, and a moonstone. And the third row, a jacinth, an agate, and an amethyst. And the fourth row, a beryl, an onyx, and a jasper. They were enclosed in settings of gold filigree. There were 12 stones with names corresponding to the names of the sons of Israel. They were like signets, each engraved with its name for the 12 tribes. They made on the breastpiece chains of pure gold, twisted like cords. And they made two settings of gold filigree and two gold rings, and put the two rings on the two edges of the breastpiece. And they put the two cords of gold in the two rings at the edges of the breastpiece. Two ends of the two cords they had attached to the two settings of filigree. In this way they attached it in front to the shoulder pieces of the ephod. Then they made two rings of gold, and put them at the two ends of the breastpiece, on its inside edge, next to the ephod. They made two rings of gold, and attached them in front to the lower part of the two shoulder pieces of the ephod, at its joining above the decorated band of the ephod. They bound the breastpiece by its rings to the rings of the ephod with a blue cord, so that it should lie on the decorated band of the ephod, and that the breastpiece should not come loose from the ephod, as the Lord had commanded Moses. He also made the robe of the ephod woven all of blue yarn, and the opening of the robe in the middle of it was like the opening in a coat of mail, with a binding around the opening so that it might not be torn. On the lower hem of the robe, they made pomegranates of blue, purple, and crimson yarns, and of fine twisted linen. They also made bells of pure gold, and put the bells between the pomegranates on the lower hem of the robe all around, between the pomegranates. A bell and a pomegranate, a bell and a pomegranate all around on the lower hem of the robe for ministering, as the Lord had commanded Moses. They also made the tunics, woven of fine linen for Aaron and his sons, and the turban of fine linen, and the headdresses of fine linen, and the linen undergarments of fine twisted linen, and the sash of fine twisted linen, and of blue, purple, and crimson yarns embroidered with needlework, as the Lord had commanded Moses. They made the rosette of the holy diadem of pure gold, and wrote on it an inscription like the engraving of a signet, "Holy to the Lord." They tied to it a blue cord to fasten it on the turban above, as the Lord had commanded Moses. In this way, all the work of the tabernacle of the tent of meeting was finished. The Israelites had done everything just as the Lord had commanded Moses. Then they brought the tabernacle to Moses, the tent and all its utensils, its hooks, its frames, its bars, its pillars and its bases, the covering of tanned ram skins, and the covering of fine leather, and the curtain for the screen, the ark of the covenant with its poles and the mercy seat, the table with all its utensils, and the bread of the presence, the pure lampstand with its lamps set on it and all its utensils, and the oil for the light, the golden altar, the anointing oil and the fragrant incense, and the screen for the entrance of the tent, the bronze altar and its grating of bronze, its poles and all its utensils, the basin with its stand, the hangings of the court, its pillars and its bases, and the screen for the gate of the court, its cords and its pegs, and all the utensils for the service of the tabernacle for the tent of meeting. The finely worked vestments for ministering in the holy place, the sacred vestments for the priest Aaron, and the vestments of his sons to serve as priests. The Israelites had done all of the work just as the Lord had commanded Moses. When Moses saw that they had done all the work just as the Lord had commanded, he blessed them.
They leave out a few tent pegs?
Nope.
A couple of almonds?
Nope.
Leaves? Yeah.
I think it's interesting that in Zechariah, where the nations are going to be coming up to keep the Feast of Tabernacles, that it says there that in that day, holiness to the Lord shall be engraved on the bells of the horse.
Mm-hmm. Wow. What is that? Zechariah what?
Zechariah 14. 20.
So I wonder if that's what's going to be engraved on it.
You know, Kevin, it's interesting because the detail that the tabernacle is put together, and we are that tabernacle, and we don't build ourselves. God chooses to dwell in temples made not by human hands.
Mm-hmm.
We don't perfect His temple through our life. He's the one that's building us and perfecting us. Do you agree with that? Somewhat?
He's working on us.
Look how much more
detail. Well, we have to get on our altar first.
We can't even figure it out.
The first thing you got to do is climb up on that altar and die to yourself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right.
You do.
And then right there. Go wash.
Mm-hmm.
We have to.
Well, we're a living sacrifice.
Pick up our cross daily.
That's right. It's good. It's a good observation.
But it's through Yeshua. I mean, everything so much is a picture of Yeshua. I mean, right down to the pillars. And, you know, the four pillars, five pillars. It's all, you know, the four Gospels, the five Torah. It's all so much Him. You got to go through Yeshua even to come in.
Zechariah 14:20.
That whole
chapter is amazing. Zechariah
14.
Oh,
I mean, you were saying that, you know, that the horses are going to have the bells, and it's going to say Kadosh Le'Yehovah.
Mm-hmm.
And it says that every cooking pot in Jerusalem will be consecrated.
Mm-hmm.
And then it says here, when that day comes, there will no longer be merchants in the house of Yahweh. Say, well, oh, remember how Yeshua went and tore up,
mm-hmm.
turned over everything? Mm-hmm. A bunch of merchants up there. That's not going to be the case in the future. So,
beautiful.
It really is. All right. So yeah, they did it exactly as the Lord commanded, and I think also too they were pretty particular because after the golden calf incident, you know, they were like, we got to prove God we're not making mistakes like that again.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I feel like they were redeeming themselves. They were really trying to illustrate or, you know, show, do it right. They were doing the best that they could. All right.
Wonder,
this is the, go ahead. I'm sorry. Yes.
I wonder if any, when they named the 12 stones that represented the 12 tribes, I wonder if a stone represented a certain tribe.
Because there was one stone for each tribe.
But I wonder which one represented which.
That's a
good question. I mean, because the only way I would think to know which one was which is, again, reckoning from Hebrew, you go from the right to the left, and you would do it in the birth order.
Mm-hmm.
That's the only way that I would know to do it. So
you think the counterfeit would be the astrology birth stones?
So I thought about
wondered that.
That. Yeah,
oh, yeah.
About
that. But it says
12
that, in verse 14, they were engraved with their names as a seal would be engraved,
mm-hmm.
each name representing one of the 12 tribes.
Mm-hmm.
So each of the stones has the name.
Yeah, you think Israel's not important?
But that's... go ahead, I'm sorry.
Well, I was just going to tell her I have a... friend in Israel that was praying. It's not Rami, it's another guy that was praying in the shower one day. You weren't here last week. And he asked the Father, how are we going to know? Because the DNA has been so, you know, how are we going to know? You know, because we're going to go in through certain gates. And he said, the light of Yeshua, when the light of Yeshua, the Lord revealed it to him in the shower, shines through you, it will put off the color of who you are.
I'm still just kind of, you know, the amazing detail that was taken care of, and I'm going, wow. But, you know, when you put yourself in the position of being one of them, one of the children of Israel that were, it was a united, I might just be just as a labor of love, you know, weaving just one part of the great, one of the little curtains that were putting it up, and I'm just putting all my love into that. All the rest of the detail was by other parts, so it was a combination of all that, of obedience to just what Father calls you to do. You know, I mean, because the whole thing would be overwhelming to get all of it right and with things that I, you know, maybe I'm not really good at making those almond branches or whatever, you know. But for the guy that did the almond branches, man, that was a labor of love. It's what he could do, you know. And in that, all of us, it comes together and the detail comes together, and it had to be everyone doing their part. And just the beauty of that, because that kind of takes some of the burden away, because we just do a labor of love what he gives you to do. You know, and that to me would be joyous, but looking at the whole thing might be rather daunting.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it
is
our part, to just keep on playing the part of the bigger part is fun.
It's like a testament to community and the importance of community coming together for him.
Yes.
They were kind of hit me. They were worshiping that idol with a goat. And so here, all of a sudden, they're willing to lay their goat down. And to me, it was just a picture of once we've been set free of whatever idols we have, we're ready to lay that down before the Father.
Oh, what a beautiful change of heart.
Yeah.
It's ridiculous.
Zechariah 14:14, it talks about the wealth transfer.
Oh, yeah, it's Isaiah, it's everywhere.
Yeah, the wealth of all the neighboring nations will be captured. Great quantities of gold and silver and fine clothing.
Isaiah 60,
chapter
5. Isaiah
chapter
60,
verse
5. Yes. Isaiah 60. Mm-hmm. Tarshish. There you go. That brings up memories for Darryl. All right, so we got our last one, chapter 40. You got it? All right. Home stretch.
Exodus 40. The Lord spoke to Moses. On the first day of the first month you shall set up the tabernacle of the tent of meeting. You shall put in it the ark of the covenant, and you shall screen the ark with the curtain. You shall bring in the table and arrange its setting, and you shall bring in the lampstand and set up its lamps. You shall put the golden altar for incense before the ark of the covenant, and set up the screen for the entrance of the tabernacle. You shall set the altar of burnt offering before the entrance of the tabernacle of the tent of meeting, and place the basin between the tent of meeting and the altar, and put water in it. You shall set up the court all around, and hang up the screen for the gate of the court. Then you shall take the anointing oil, and anoint the tabernacle and all that is in it, and consecrate it and all its furniture, so that it shall become holy. You shall also anoint the altar of burnt offering, and all its utensils, and consecrate the altar, so that the altar shall be most holy. You shall also anoint the basin with its stand, and consecrate it.
Then you shall bring Aaron and his sons to the entrance of the tent of meeting, and shall wash them with water, and put on Aaron the sacred vestments, and you shall anoint him and consecrate him, so that he may serve me as priest. You shall bring his sons also, and put tunics on them, and anoint them, as you anointed their father, that they may serve me as priests. And their anointing shall admit them to a perpetual priesthood throughout all generations to come.
Moses did everything just as the Lord had commanded him. In the first month, in the second year, on the first day of the month, the tabernacle was set up. Moses set up the tabernacle. He laid its bases and set up its frames and put in its poles and raised up its pillars. And he spread the tent over the tabernacle and put the covering of the tent over it, as the Lord had commanded Moses. He took the covenant and put it into the ark and put the poles on the ark and set the mercy seat above the ark. And he brought the ark into the tabernacle and set up the curtain for screening and screened the ark of the covenant, as the Lord had commanded Moses. He put the table in the tent of meeting on the north side of the tabernacle outside the curtain and set the bread in order on it before the Lord, as the Lord had commanded Moses. He put the lampstand in the tent of meeting opposite the table on the south side of the tabernacle and set up the lamps before the Lord, as the Lord had commanded Moses. He put the golden altar in the tent of meeting before the curtain and offered fragrant incense on it, as the Lord had commanded Moses. He also put in place the screen for the entrance of the tabernacle. He set the altar of burnt offering at the entrance of the tabernacle of the tent of meeting and offered on it the burnt offering and the grain offering, as the Lord had commanded Moses. He set the basin between the tent of meeting and the altar and put water in it for washing, with which Moses and Aaron and his sons washed their hands and their feet. When they went into the tent of meeting and when they approached the altar, they washed, as the Lord had commanded Moses. He set up the court around the tabernacle and the altar and put up the screen at the gate of the court. So Moses finished the work.
Okay, one second. Because the reason I'm stopping is because we are in a situation now. This is the moment, right? Think about it. It's been about a year. They've been building. Moses is finally in there. He's lit the fire. He's turned on the menorah. He's got the incense going. They can probably smell it now. There's got to be excitement around the camp going, what's going to happen now? We're almost done. What do we do now? Mm-hmm. And Moses, he's doing the last pieces. This is the consecration. See, this is the work that God is doing, like in our tabernacles, and he's perfecting it. Mm-hmm. And so now, right now, Moses has gotten to this point now. He's like, everybody's done everything. I've done everything I can. We've got it launched. Now the space shuttle is ready to take off, so to speak, right? So now I'm just kind of setting the moment, you know, for you guys. All the work has been done, this detail, to get us to this moment. And now what happens?
So Moses finished the work. Then the cloud covered the tent of meeting, and the glory of the Lord filled the tabernacle. Moses was not able to enter the tent of meeting because the cloud settled upon it, and the glory of the Lord filled the tabernacle. Whenever the cloud was taken up from the tabernacle, the Israelites would set out on each stage of their journey. But if the cloud was not taken up, then they did not set out until the day that it was taken up. For the cloud of the Lord was on the tabernacle by day, and fire was in the cloud by night, before the eyes of all the house of Israel at each stage of their journey.
That is my, I mean, if you really think about it, that is my, the whole community now could see the manifestation of God right there, blessing and saying, thank you guys, it's suitable, the creator of the universe can come and show up. You guys did a good job. Whoosh! I mean, can you imagine the celebration?
Yeah.
And everybody was like, oh. I mean, I wish I could have a video of it. You know, I think it'd be amazing just to see what was going on. I mean, and so.
What if the tech rehearsal is out?
Oh, it's on.
Wow.
And so, congratulations! Now you guys got through the second book of this year's study. And Vayikra is interesting because the word Vayikra means, and he called, the Vav is a joiner, right? The six is a nail you establish, it's like you connect two boards together. It literally means and, because you're joining a thought, like Kevin and Amanda were joined together. Vayikra, and he called. So it's like now that everything is set up and ready to go, Leviticus is now, okay, how do we deal with God? How do we approach this holy, all-consuming fire God that is just like
done the most amazing things and set up something that's never been set up before. How do we approach this God? And so that's what Leviticus, what we're getting ready to read for the next 8 weeks, is all about. Is now, you see how logically it's built up and it's gotten us to this point? And so we're going to read a lot of details over the next 8 weeks on how this was all done. And there's a lot of lessons that we can learn as we apply to it. But anyway, it's been a tremendous joy on our journey so far this year in this cycle.
And that's all I have time for tonight. Unfortunately, we don't have time to go into some of the other things, but if you would like to continue the study on your own, you can check out the links on virtualhousechurch.com and go down to the left-hand menu and look for Exodus Week 22, and you can read the Torah commentary by Ardell that we are used to doing, 2008, 2009, 2010. They're all linked right there for you. And also, you might want to check out the portion from the prophets, which is Ezekiel 36, verse 16 through verse 38, and in the New Testament, Mark chapter 6, verses 14 through 29, and John chapter 6, verses 1 through 71. All right. Thank you so much for listening. Shabbat Shalom, everybody. We'll see you back here on the Revolutionary Radio Project, hopefully next Wednesday from 10 p.m. to midnight, Central Standard Time, and then, of course, Virtual House Church 23, Lord willing, on 322. 322.13. We'll see what happens. Keep us in your prayers if you would. We'd appreciate it. Again, thank you so much, and have a great night, everybody.